The Ryan Tubridy Show on RTE Radio 1, sponsored by Sky Broadband. With our broadband, your world is limitless. Live beyond.
But I want to go to our guest, Scarlett Curtis, writer, blogger, activist and curator of the best-selling Feminists Don't Wear Pink and Other Lies, presenting an extraordinary anthology now of writing from over 70 contributors on what mental health means to them. And it features famous voices, campaigners, world-class authors, musicians and experts in their fields. It's Not Okay to Feel Blue and Other Lies is essentially a call to arms to tackle the nuance and prevalence of mental illness. Scarlett Curtis, good morning to you. Nice to talk to you.
Morning. Thank you for having me.
How are you doing today, it being a Monday morning?
I'm okay today, but yeah, I loved what you just said because I think Mondays can be very, very hard for a lot of people. Sunday nights and Mondays are always my, when it gets a bit tough.
The tricky one. I think, Scarlett, yeah. It's been thus for generations, I think, for some strange reason. Have you investigated that? Do you know why do you think people feel that they get the heebie-jeebies on a Sunday night?
I'm not sure. I think it's that feeling when you're back to work, isn't it? And everything seems a bit tough.
Yeah, and I think it goes back from when you're a kid, doesn't it? When you're going back to school on a Monday and it just stays with you for some strange reason.
Exactly, that feeling you used to get when you knew that it was going to be a whole another 5 days until you'd get a weekend.
You know, the issue of mental health, which is what your new book is about, was for years not discussed in, I don't know, about the UK, but certainly in Ireland, not in any meaningful way. And then something happened about, what, 5, 6, 7 years ago, when it became okay to use the word or expression to talk about it. Have you found that it's a much healthier place to be media-wise?
Completely, yeah. I mean, I first started really suffering from depression and anxiety about 7 years ago. Mm-hmm. And when I was going through it at the beginning, I truly thought I was like the first person in the world who'd ever had depression. And I felt so alone and so ashamed. And I think the shame is the thing that we're really trying to tackle with this book, because the shame just makes you cut yourself off from your friends. It makes you feel like you can never talk about it. And it was only when I kind of really started to read things online and when I started to talk about it myself that I realized just how many people in my own life and online were going through the same thing that I was going through.
And do you think all roads lead to the operation you were having for scoliosis when you were a teenager?
Yeah, I think so. I had this operation that went quite wrong. And then I was diagnosed with depression, anxiety and PTSD. So it was all kind of as a result of that. And I think for me, one of the biggest things was when I came out of being in pain and I was no longer in pain and I could walk again, I kind of thought that I'd be so happy and that everything would be fixed. And suddenly my brain just really started to suffer. And while it was really hard being physically in pain, when it was in my brain and when, you know, that was the thing that was holding me back from living a normal life, I felt so embarrassed about that because it felt like it was something I could control and that no one would really understand.
It's a terrible, two terrible words, shame and embarrassment, because neither word is in any way fairly applicable to what you're talking about. And yet people who suffer from both apply it to themselves.
Yeah, completely. And I think part of the illness often makes you feel like you're not worth being helped. You know, it makes you feel like you've got yourself in this situation or in some way it's your fault, or maybe that you're not quite bad enough to ask for help. I think that's something I hear from a lot of people is like, oh, I get a bit depressed, I get a bit anxious, but it can't be bad enough to ask for help. And actually, you know, the thing I always say is that mental health is just like physical health. And if you had a toothache or, you know, if your foot was hurting, you'd never go, oh, but it's not bad enough to warrant help. You would just ask for help. And the same should be said of your brain.
Intriguing to hear you talk there a minute ago about PTSD, post-traumatic stress disorder. You talked about being diagnosed with depression, anxiety and PTSD, which you call the fun big three, obviously with your tongue in cheek. But, you know, PTSD comes from where, in your case, came from what was the medical illness in terms of the operations and so on?
Yeah, it was just the whole experience and some things that happened during that time. And yeah, but it was definitely a label I wasn't that familiar with, and I kind of thought only happened to like soldiers when they got back from the war, or someone who'd been through a huge traumatic incident. And it took me a long time to wrap my head around the idea that that could be something that applied to me.
Tell me a little bit about your recovery then, and also looking for an explanation. If you were, you know, when you were in your case, for example, and you were depressed and you had all these diagnoses, at what point do you think I'm kind of drifting into the quicksand here?
It's really hard. Yeah, and it does happen quite quickly. I mean, for me, it was very extreme. You know, I could barely step out of my house without having a panic attack. I totally shut myself off from all my friends. I even shut myself off from my family. You know, I've got three younger brothers, and when I talk to them now, they say that they barely knew what was going on. They would just kind of hear me crying in my bedroom and were told not to come in and talk to me. So quite quickly, my life really spiraled into this place where my mental illness was controlling everything. And, you know, I'd missed a lot of school. I had no friends. And I think what's hard about any of these issues is you have to fix what's going on in your head, but you also have to try and pull back some kind of a life for yourself, because so often what these mental health issues do is make you not live your life in the way you'd want to live.
You got so bad that you attempted suicide. And that is the darkest point of anyone's life, clearly.
Yeah.
Can you kind of inform us a little bit as to what brought you to the cusp and what took you away from the ledge?
Yeah, I mean, I think so. This book, we've done it in partnership with this amazing charity called Shout, and they're a 24/7 crisis text line. So you can text in when you're in crisis. It's the equivalent of a suicide hotline. And the reason I wanted to do it for that charity is because when I did get to that night where I tried to take my own life, it was actually a suicide hotline that I called when I, you know, realized that I maybe was making the wrong decision. And if there was something about that anonymous call, and, you know, I think by that point I felt like I was such a burden on my family and my friends, which wasn't true, but it was what my brain was telling me. And there was something amazing about having that anonymous person at the end of a phone that just really gave me the fraction of hope that I needed in that moment.
And it was just that, as you call it, fraction was enough to get you over the line to bring you back from the brink.
Totally. And I think in those moments, you know, anyone that's had really bad depression will know that suicidal thoughts come along with that. You know, it's something that I think is a lot more common than we tend to talk about. And in that moment, when you're having those thoughts, just reaching out to a friend or someone anonymous or someone in your family, it can often be that one text or that one call that is just the one little thing that you need in that moment to make sure that you don't go as low as your brain is telling you you need to go.
Why, can I ask you, Scarlett, why do you kind of sometimes refer to yourself in terms like, I'm a posh white English girl? You know, you're very aware, your background is, you know, what, your great-grandfather was Sigmund Freud, your father's Richard Curtis and so on. And that would probably make people say, well, what would she know? And are you kind of deflecting that by admitting it, owning it, if you like, really quickly?
I don't know if I'm deflecting it, but it's definitely something I find very interesting to look at. You know, on the one hand, I had every privilege and comfort in the world, and still managed to get to this point where my brain was completely collapsed. And I think that's something that shows that actually these issues can affect you no matter what situation you're in. But also, I'm very aware that within all of this, I always had access to treatment. My parents could always pay for my medication if they needed to. You know, I always had access to those things, and that is completely not the reality for so many people. And that was one of the main reasons I wanted to do this book in collaboration with so many other people, is because I think we need to talk about the ways in which mental health isn't equal. You know, so many people don't have access to care. I think on average, it takes a young person around 10 years to find adequate treatment for their mental health, which is so ridiculous and so awful. And so I really wanted to just acknowledge that my story wasn't the norm when it comes to having access to help.
So it's kind of, it's democratic in its cruelty.
Yeah, it can affect everyone, but also the ways we can all get treatment are definitely not equal.
How did you decide, very good point, by the way, how did you decide who to ask to contribute to your book? Because I see, you know, in the book you've got Emma Thompson saying, you know, take a cold shower, or watch documentaries about serial killers, or Alistair Campbell writing a eulogy for his brother Donald, who suffered from schizophrenia. Or Miranda Hart revealing that she's an introvert to the surprise of some. did you alight upon these people yourself, or was it a selection of old friends, or how did you decide who makes it into the book with their stories?
Well, so there's 74 people in the book, so yes, there's a lot of people. I think part of it was I wanted to get people that were well known and that people loved, because I think there is something really powerful when you are maybe so ashamed of your mental health, or ashamed of being an introvert, or ashamed of having anxiety, and then you read about someone you really admire who goes through the same issues as you. I know from personal experience how much of a relief that can be. And then with those people, that was kind of that. And then there are also so many amazing kind of mental health advocates and activists in the book who give a really great insight into, you know, how this is all going, what's happening in the current generation with mental health.
You talk about your family a bit, and you have done in the past. And here, there's a quote that I found kind of eye-catching. You said, "There's a long line of very dodgy men in my family." Could you explain that to our listeners who wouldn't understand that?
I think that quote was slightly taken out of context. But
okay, well, put it back into context for us then.
Yeah, well, it's just been interesting for me over the years, kind of looking into Sigmund Freud and all his writings. And, you know, he was very much considered a pioneer in this field. But I think a lot of his attitudes towards women were maybe not quite what you'd want from someone today, at least.
He was your great-great-grandfather.
Yes.
What are the knockout points, Scarlett, that make you put your, you know, face palm when you think of what he said?
I'm not sure how many of them I can say. He definitely had some not great views on female pleasure and female sexuality, which is something that I also have. I do a lot of feminist activism, and that's something we're definitely very against.
Of course. But you probably have to. You can't disregard him. Is that, would that be fair to say?
Yeah, or? I think you definitely can't disregard him. But I also think sometimes we talk about him too much. You know, the thing with all of this mental health conversation is, I really do feel we're still so at the beginning of it. Like, yeah, when Sigmund Freud was working, he was still using the term hysteria, which was given to women who, probably looking back now, they had some form of anxiety and they were kind of labelled as hysteric and sort of locked away. So I think when everyone's talking about how big this conversation around mental health is now, we have to acknowledge how recent it even is that we're using these terms and talking in a responsible way about these issues.
But there is something, I suppose, quite, there's a nice symmetry to it, that his great-great-granddaughter is, no, but you're essentially rebooting the language of mental health for this generation in a way that he did for his.
I hope so, yeah. I mean, it would be nice if that was the case.
I just want to briefly mention your book, Feminists Don't Wear Pink and Other Lies, which was a big hit in my house, I have to say.
And, oh, that's nice.
No, it's really important, because I just think for younger girls to read stories like this and just to be moved in a political sense as much as anything else is great. So what did you feel was the greatest achievement from that book in terms of, we'd be doing signings and talks, what were you most proud of or happy with, what people would say to you about that book?
I think the thing with that book that I was so proud of was just how many really young girls sort of saw something in it and picked it up and became interested in feminism.
Yes.
You know, I have this thing which I truly believe, which is that no one ever says, I used to be a feminist, but now I'm not one anymore. You know, generally, once you've converted, you're in it for life. And so the idea that we could be getting kind of 12, 13, 14 year old girls interested in this issue, hopefully that's something they'll then take into the rest of their lives and maybe not come into some of the situations that a lot of women have been put in.
You met one of our friends, and I say that because she's on our shows quite a lot, is Saoirse Ronan.
Yes.
Back in May, you came to Dublin. I saw you on the news. You recorded a live episode of your podcast with Saoirse, isn't that right?
And, yes.
How did you meet her?
So we actually became friends quite a few years ago when we were living in New York, and she was doing a play there and I was in university, and we just sort of very quickly bonded, and she's one of my best friends in the world. So I'm very obsessed with the Irish through her.
In what sense? What? Tell me about your obsession.
I think there's actually... I'm actually very... When we were in Dublin, so many of the girls that came to our show had been very involved in the repeal campaign. And we talked to a lot of them afterwards, and there just feels like there's this real fire and excitement within the feminist movement among Irish women and men that maybe... that I think's really been pioneered by a lot of incredible young women, and it feels like a really exciting time to be an Irish woman at the moment. Or an Irish feminist.
Yes, indeed. You placed copies of your new book randomly on the tube last week. Is that right?
Yes, I actually did two more this morning when I was on my way to do this show.
Did you? And tell me the purpose. You just leave them down? No one... Yeah, and what happens?
I mean, I'm really hoping they don't just all end up in lost property. But we have these big stickers on them. And I, for years, could never take the tube or any kind of public transport or fly. I mean... the idea of getting into a tube or a plane would just give me a panic attack to even think about. So I wanted to kind of put them there just in case anyone was having maybe an anxious moment on the tube and could pick up the book. Also, the nice thing about the book is there's lots of very short pieces. So I think it is quite a good tube book or even a very good toilet book if you want something by your loo.
Depending on what you're doing or where.
Yeah.
Scarlett, congratulations on it. I think that between the two books, actually, you're shining a light where it needs to be shone. So thank you for joining us this morning to talk about that.
Thank you so much.
Really nice to talk to you.
Me.
Not at all.
Scarlett, nice to talk to you.
Likewise. Thank you, Scarlett Curtis. Our book is called It's Not Okay to Feel Blue and Other Lies. And that's curated, as I say, by Scarlett Curtis. It's a Penguin book. And that's in shops now. Scarlett Curtis. That's the name. That's the book. And I think perfect reading of a Monday morning, I would have thought. It's 22 minutes to 10.